The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we're discussing some fascinating science history with two books about the passion and perseverance that drive scientific discovery. A little later on, we'll speak to science writer Jessica Wapner about her new book, The Philadelphia Chromosome, A Mutant Gene and the Quest to Cure Cancer at the Genetic Level. But first, let's learn about the transit of Venus in 1769 and the competing expeditions that went racing to observe it. My guest is Mark Anderson, who's covered science, history, and technology for many media outlets, including Discover, Wired, and National Public Radio. He's a contributing editor for IEEE Spectrum magazine and a contributing producer to WNYC Public Radio International's Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson. And he's here to talk about his book, The Day the World Discovered the Sun. An extraordinary story of scientific adventure and the race to track the transit of Venus. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's go way back to June 6, 1761. Now we have astronomers all over the world staring breathlessly through telescopes. What are they watching for?
They're watching for a dot crossing a disk, kind of a circle within a circle. What it is the planet Venus crosses the path of the sun, as seen from the Earth, very, very rarely, about twice per century. And there are reasons why it matters in the 21st century. But back then, it mattered because nobody really knew the physical dimensions of the solar system. So they didn't know how many miles separated the planets, how many miles separated the Earth and the sun. They knew the proportions, but they didn't know the actual real dimensions. So that was a real pressing scientific challenge. There was also the challenge of navigation at sea. And while that might seem completely unrelated, it turns out there were some fascinating applications of this science to that present day technological challenge.
Well, how did they navigate in 1761?
Well, mostly by what's called dead reckoning. Navigation is essentially, as anyone who has a smartphone knows, you need to know essentially two numbers or two dimensions. You need to know where you are, where you are north-south and where you are east-west. And if you know where you want to go and you know the route you want to take, essentially it's those two numbers that you need. Put into the parlance of navigators, it's what's your latitude and what's your longitude. Latitude is relatively easy because there is a North Pole and there's a North Star. And so you just find, it's a little bit more complicated than this, but essentially if you can find the North Star, then you know your latitude. And in fact, if you can find the sun and you know the time of year, then you can also find your latitude. So navigators at sea have known and been able to find their latitudes for centuries upon centuries. But the hard problem is longitude, because there is no East Star. There is no West Star like there is in North Star. That's because the Earth is spinning in that direction. So there's no fixed point. So you're constantly having to figure out where everything is with respect to everything else. It's an extremely difficult problem. So effectively what that meant for navigators in the 18th century was they just had to kind of guess. And there were a lot of people, a lot of sailors that paid the ultimate price because, they got lost at sea. They ended up, there was a famous shipwreck in off the coast of England where more than 1,000 sailors died in one night because the captain of that fleet thought that they were entering the English Channel when in fact they were going into this craggy archipelago of islands that practically all the ships wrecked on it, and it decimated a large portion of the English Navy at the time. So navigation was indeed a very big deal, navigation at sea. And it turns out that the heavens had the solution to the longitude problem as well.
Okay, so we have astronomers waiting with various degrees of impatience for the transit of Venus. And I do want to explain that this wasn't an event that you could just walk out into the backyard to see. People had mounted serious expeditions to get to places where they could record the details accurately. So why was that necessary?
Triangulation, in one word. So if you want to measure the distance between the Earth and the Sun, which is ultimately what these scientists were doing, you need multiple reference points across the Earth. And so it's like drawing big right triangles. You need two legs of that right triangle, ideally one near the equator and one as far north, or, you know, as close to the North Pole as possible, or as close to the South Pole as possible. So what this meant was this was a gigantic adventure for scores of scientists. And as I said, it only happened at most twice per century. At the beginning of the 1700s, Edmund Halley, the famous man behind Halley's Comet, predicted in the early 1700s that the planet Venus would pass in front of the Sun. And he realized just how significant that would be for really piecing together the architecture of, you know, the near universe. I mean, it was a cosmological question, and he realized he wouldn't live to see that day. He regretted that famously for the rest of his life. But people knew that June of 1761 would be kind of the first of two opportunities to really measure out the solar system, which at that time was, you know, the heavens and the earth, and the, you know, it was the thing that God spent his first day creating, you know, so it was a big deal.
Well, how accurate were their measurements?
It was good in 1761, and it was much better in 1769, to be extremely technical with you there. The problem was they knew that they didn't know, and various people had different estimates, and nobody had a really firm fix on how good their estimates were. So then in 1761, they were really able to refine that, but it turns out that they discovered lots of problems along the way. Most famously, they found something called the black drop effect, which is that it was an optical problem that nobody had anticipated. Any practicing scientist will tell you, I mean, you set out one goal, and invariably there's going to be, you know, a number of hurdles along the way, and this was one of those unanticipated hurdles. So people had problems in 1761 getting it just right, but fortunately there was a second opportunity.
Well, and you said that it occurs twice in a century, but it does follow a pattern, right?
I mean, there are a few exceptions, but generally Venus transits come 8 years apart. So when you have one, then you have another that's 8 years later. So there was one in 1761, and then there was one in 1769. Just this last year, we had one of these rare Venus transits in June of last year, in June of 2012. That was preceded by one in June of 2004. But there were no Venus transits throughout the whole of the 20th century. You have to go back to the 1880s and 1870s.
So the 1761 one went, you know, adequately, let's say, and the 1769 one. So did people start planning pretty much right after the 1761 for the 1769? Is that how long those planning the expedition
took?
Yeah.
And there are household names that became household names because of the Venus transit. I think it's worth mentioning, for instance, Mason and Dixon, the famous surveyors who in the United States, you know, mapped out the line that bears their name. The Mason-Dixon line only is the Mason-Dixon line because of the 1761 Venus transit. That is to say, Charles Mason and Jeremiah Dixon were first paired together to observe the Venus transit of 1761 in Cape Town, present-day South Africa. And they did a very good job, although they were their ship was practically sunk. 1761 was also in the middle of the Seven Years' War, where England and France were fighting one another. It was just a giant, you know, Baroque mess, like many things in the 18th century. But in any event, England and France were at war, and France practically sunk Mason and Dixon's ship. Nevertheless, they made it to South Africa. That wasn't their original destination, but they were able to do excellent observations of the Venus transit of 1761. They came back, they reported their results, and the powers that be in England, the scientific and other powers that be saw that, saw their results and said, you know, hey, you guys, you did such a great job with this astronomical observation. There's this small surveying question we need you to address in the colonies. And so Mason and Dixon are Mason and Dixon because of the Venus transit observation. And, you know, Thomas Pynchon wrote a whole novel called Mason Dixon about their amazing adventure. And I have a bit of their adventure in The Day the World Discovered the Sun. The other is James Cook, Captain Cook. Again, he would not be Captain Cook, but for the transit of Venus in 1769, the Royal Society in England hired him to outfit a ship to go around the world to Tahiti, which was just newly discovered by the English at that time, because it was realized that would be the ideal place to perform this observation. So he planned this around the world voyage that was, for the 18th century, that was essentially like the Apollo missions in the 1960s. It was that big of a deal, and it excited the imagination of so many people, among them Samuel Taylor Coleridge, whose teacher even went on that expedition with Captain Cook. But anyway, so the Venus transits were kind of a test bed for a lot of science and technology in the 18th century, and it really, in some important ways, really opened up the world.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm here with Mark Anderson, author of the book The Day the World Discovered the Sun, an extraordinary story of scientific adventure and the race to track the transit of Venus. Okay, so you have started talking about the cast of characters, which is lovely because it's brilliant. So tell us about some of the other ones.
In 1761, there were scores of observations of the transit of Venus, and there was more than 100 observations of the 1769 transit of Venus. So to tell an encyclopedic account of those two stories would indeed be an encyclopedia, and it wouldn't be terribly thrilling, I have to say. So when I sat down to kind of write a narrative story, you know, almost, I mean, it's not a novel, but I took some of the, you know, I used kind of a novelist's approach of, you know, getting knowable and fascinating characters, but, you know, a small cast of characters that the reader can kind of become familiar with and admire and scowl at and everything. So these are real flawed and fascinating characters. So what I realized is that the way to do this is to just pick a handful, just really two or three of the very best observations, telling the, you know, the most amazing adventure stories with some of the very best science. And so what I wound up doing was in 1761, I told Mason and Dixon's story, and I also told the story of a French explorer who was kind of the French counterpart of Benjamin Franklin. I mean, he was a polymath par excellence, and he was just an amazing character. His name is Jean-Baptiste Chappe, C-H-A-P-P-E. He traveled all the way to Siberia, remote Siberia, in 1761. it was at the behest of Catherine the Great, and he was, it turned into quite an adventure for him as he faced down a whole village that thought he was going to bring the end of the world. These sort of superstitious villagers in this Siberian town thought that, you know, that the Venus transit might spell the end times, you know, and that this astronomer had come to town to help usher in the end of the world. He had death threats, and he had to have soldiers posted at his observatory for fear that, you know, that the villagers would rise up against him. And then he collected some good data in 1761, but the ultimate result was not satisfactory. Unfortunately, the world, you know, the scientific powers in England and France and elsewhere had this second chance. And so in 1769, there were, as I said, more than 100 observations. But I told Schaap's story because he went to Baja, Mexico in 1769. And I told the story of Captain Cook as he traveled around the world to go to Tahiti. And then I also told the story of a scientist who was a Jesuit named, if you can believe it, Hell. And he traveled at the invitation of the King of Denmark, who was also crazy, literally, to go up and observe. You can't make this stuff up. It's just amazing.
I love that part.
He traveled to the Arctic, or above the Arctic Circle, to one of the northernmost towns in continental Europe, in present-day Norway. And it was just phenomenal. Each of these stories were phenomenal adventure stories, but, you know, in the service of world-changing science. And I'd love to talk a little bit about the longitude question, too.
Tell us about Cook, Green, and Banks, specifically.
So he was Lieutenant Cook at the time, but he's known to us as Captain Cook. He was a then obscure naval officer who had done some amazing observations, in fact, and mapping of parts of Canada. And the scientists at the Royal Society got together, and they picked him out as a promising leader of this expedition to observe the Venus transit. But he needed some good astronomers with him, too. So he picked some of the top astronomers in England at the time, including Charles Green. But also, this was an opportunity to really explore the whole new worlds. And so there were naturalists who were just champing at the bit at the opportunity, you know, to really discover the flora and fauna of these new regions of the globe, an independently wealthy man named Joseph Banks was able to actually help pay for the expedition and performed a lot of amazing natural history, performed a lot of zoological and biological observations and chronicled new species and, you know, quote unquote, discovered the kangaroo, among many other things.
Well, I just need to point out, like, the science was so strong in this man that he would sneak ashore even when Cook told him that it was dangerous.
Yeah. I mean, Cook's stories are well chronicled, and they are quite amazing. And I wanted to give readers a flavor of the story, but I didn't want to concentrate on that because also, as I said, I mean, Cook's story has been told before, but these other adventures really haven't. And in fact, with Maximilian Hell, the friar who went up to the top of the earth with his intrepid assistant, Janos Szynowicz, they're equally amazing adventure story, which it could, you know, in some ways could be like Laurel and Hardy travel to the Arctic Circle. And Szynowicz is, I mean, they're both just amazing characters. And Szynowicz is this gourmand who's like constantly grousing about the food and the people and everything. It's just tremendously entertaining. But the thing is, I was able to bring out really for the first time, their whole story because, their travel journals were in Latin, and they'd never even been published in English before. So I had them independently, you know, I hired out a translator to translate these hundreds of pages of travel journal entries. Now, of course, I just picked out the choicest bits for my chapter on, or my chapters on Hell and Szynowicz's journey up to the North Pole, or up to the edge of the North Pole. So, I want to certainly tip my hat towards those guys as well. And same with Shap. I mean, I was able to piece together his story for the first time as he traveled across Mexico and across the Atlantic Ocean, across the Gulf of California to Baja, Mexico, where there was an epidemic. We think today it was probably typhus that was ravaging the entire local population. And but nevertheless, he stayed put. And even though he knew he was risking his life and the life of everyone in his party, the science was far too important to him, and he risked life and limb to get the observations, and his data was as good as Cook's and as good as Hell and Szynowicz's, and it really helped to for the first time in human history really fix our place in the universe.
We should say at a certain point their expeditions became very much less about scientific journeys and very much more about simple survival.
Survival, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's, to me, it was the opportunity of talking about these Venus transit voyages was, you know, it was like talking about cutting edge science today, like the Hubble Space Telescope or the Large Hadron Collider or something, combined with Edmund Hillary climbing to the top of Mount Everest. I mean, it was just amazing adventure coupled with cutting edge science. It was just a tremendous story, opportunity for telling a great story.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm here with Mark Anderson, author of the book, The Day the World Discovered the Sun. Okay, so maybe give me just what was going on immediately before the transit of Venus, maybe the last few weeks. What were they up against?
In some ways, I think the words of the explorers themselves might do better justice to the material than my attempt to summarize it. There's just some tremendous material in the logbooks of a number of these explorers. Let me read to you what the explorers traveling to the Baja Peninsula encountered. Here they are making their way across west of Mexico City, and Jean-Baptiste Schaap's assistant records, "High mountains, dreadful precipices, dry deserts offered to us every day some new dangers. We came near dying 1,000 times. We were besides crushed by an excessive heat, which hardly left us strength enough to drag ourselves around. Having reached to some valley or on the slope of some hills, we tried to take on the bare ground under the canopy of heaven some rest so necessary on account of our cruel fatigue. We would be hardly half asleep, and we would be woke up all at once by some violent wind followed by a heavy rain, and some sweeping torrents would cause us to fly with all we had, afraid at every step of following into some of those precipices which surrounded us." That's the kind of stuff that they're up against to make it to Baja, Mexico, to observe the transit of Venus there. Hal and Shinovich, as they're making their way to the, again, one of the northernmost towns in continental Europe above the Arctic Circle. Let me just read a little bit of Shinovich's journal as they're making their way. And it was, some people considered it sort of a suicide mission to be traveling up there in the winter. They had to go many, many months in advance to make it up there and set up their observatory in time for the June 1769 transit. Shinovich writes, "We had to sail on a famously dangerous 8-mile portion of the sea, known for the many shipwrecks situated far away from the shores. Our ship was lifted as high on a mountain, as high as on a mountain by the ever-growing waves, and then it seemed to be falling back to the bottom of the sea, and then it was being thrown around to the left and the right, threatening to fall apart among creaking sounds. The rainy fog was making the situation even more dangerous because we could not see the mountains nor the rocks in the sea."
Okay, and then there was, do you have a piece there by any chance about the illness that hit the Chap expedition? Because that has to be just after everything else that they've been through, suddenly just a horrible illness. That's unjust.
Yeah, no, it was incredible. You know, I'd read all the horrors that they had to face down just to cross Mexico on their mule train, and it was this incredible adventure just making it to their destination. But then they get there and they discover that a third of the population of the peninsula, or that region of the peninsula, had died from this epidemic that was sweeping the entire region. And so the Spanish soldiers who were accompanying Chap and his French team basically wanted to, you know, hightail it out of there, because they knew that they were risking their very lives just by staying put. But Chap realized that this is the place, and it was not stubbornness on his part. He just, they landed with only, you know, a week or two to spare. They had to find a suitable location somewhere that they could set it, where he could set up an observatory, sort of a makeshift observatory. And so he realized this is do or die. We've got to make this observation or the whole mission is worthless. So they set up even while villagers were dying around them. And then in the days, literally just a few days before the Venus transit, people in his own party started getting sick. And then Chap himself started getting sick, and he logged, even, you know, as he was battling this horrible fever, he nevertheless logged superlative astronomical data, recording, you know, down to the second, the duration of the Venus transit. He observed a subsequent lunar eclipse so that they could get an exact fix on the location of the observatory, which was absolutely necessary for making this data useful. You know, and all while he was sweating under, this tremendous fever, and he had assistants who were succumbing to this disease, and the local, you know, the local population were dying in droves. And here he was, you know, he had decided he had to stay put and sweat it out.
And the Cook expedition, again, after everything they had already been through, and I do love those pieces, but after everything, an islander stole part of the telescope.
That's right. So they landed on Tahiti after a number of encounters in South America with the local populations. There was a mayor the Portuguese mayor in Rio de Janeiro didn't even believe that the English would be crazy enough to send a naval ship halfway around the world to observe some planet or something. So he just thought that they were reconnoitering the Portuguese colonies for some military takeover. So he practically held Captain Cook hostage, but he finally had to let them go when he realized he couldn't prove his claim. But anyway, Cook makes it through the Pacific, through a very trying and arduous journey around the Cape and into the Pacific. He lands on Tahiti. They make friends with the native Tahitians, and they set up their fort called Fort Venus. It remains named Fort Venus to this day on the tip of Tahiti. And so they set up their telescopes, but they discover they discover a couple things, one of which is that there seems to be kind of an easy sense of property, shall we say.
Well put.
People just kind of borrow things from one another readily. And they also discover that, and these, you know, this is a ship full of young men, and they discover as they land that the Tahitian women were readily forthcoming with their affections in exchange for iron. If men could provide just a nail or two, they might enjoy some time with some of the natives. And in fact, there was an English ship that practically fell apart in the harbor because so many men had pried nails out of the ship's boards.
Oh, that's great.
And Cook knew this, and he actually stocked extra barrels of nails just in case. He didn't tell his men this, but he was not going to have his ship fall apart. But he put strict prohibitions against, you know, consorting with the natives. Nevertheless, there certainly was some degree of this exchange going on all in the background. And then you have, yeah, people stealing his telescopes, and they go chasing through the jungle after their scientific instruments, which again would have completely compromised the mission if those weren't found. But they were able to track it down. There was a moment, you know, which almost ended in a massacre. But fortunately, Joseph Banks came to the rescue. He sat down with the head of this local tribe and sort of talked out a settlement, and out came the telescope, and they walked away without any with just a little bit of tension in the air, but nothing more.
I have so many questions about the stories that happened during this period, but quite honestly, I feel like if I ask them, then I am spoiling the book for someone, because these are, as you said, a lot of these characters are not well known. So why aren't they more well known?
I think they should be more well known, and as, you know, sort of founding fathers of astronomy, certainly in terms of knowing our place and our, you know, sort of the size of the cosmos and the size of the local universe at the time. The astronomers at the time were also not just solving these more academic questions of the size scales of the universe and things like that, but they were also solving the practical questions of the time, namely navigation at sea. And what Cook was the first to test was essentially an 18th century GPS system using the moon as the global positioning satellite. And what they had done is really come up with the first practical solution to the navigation problem, using the moon's exact position as the way to tell Greenwich time. And once you have Greenwich time and compare that to your local time, then you know your longitude. So Cook was able to field test this solution on his Venus transit voyage. And in fact, some of the astronomers, many of the astronomers behind these Venus transit expeditions and behind the Venus transit calculations and the data crunchers, they were also the crucial people who had provided this longitude solution. It's especially noteworthy today because this year marks the 250th anniversary of the first book, The Stake in the Ground, that spelled the beginning of this longitude solution. And it's essentially what enabled people to navigate, you know, throughout the 18th century, really throughout the Age of Empire. So it's kind of cool that these amazing voyages and these incredible adventures, you know, they're not just important in the history of science, but they're also really important in the history of navigation and in the history of voyages.
Okay, you've made my decision for me. And it might bother my audience, and I'm probably going to get emails about this, but I am going to leave our interview here. So if you want to know how it all ends, go pick up the book. That's Mark Anderson's The Day the World Discovered the Sun. And Mark, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Desiree. This has been a great pleasure.
You can find a link to Mark Anderson's The Day the World Discovered the Sun on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back to talk about the Philadelphia chromosome with Jessica Wapner after this.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. My guest is Jessica Wapner, a New York freelance writer focused mainly on healthcare and medicine. Her work is published in places like The New York Times, Scientific American, Slate, and Science, and her writing on cancer research and treatment appears in magazines Oncology Business Review, Cure, and CR. Her blog, Work in Progress, is part of the PLOS blog network and focuses on the ethics and economics of drug development. Jessica, wonderful to have you back on the show, and this time the author of a book. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, and it's great to be back on the show.
Well, now the book is The Philadelphia Chromosome. Why write a book about chronic myeloid leukemia?
Well, the story behind The Philadelphia Chromosome is the origin story for how we got to our current moment in cancer research and treatment. The book tells the story behind the creation of a drug called Gleevec, which was the first drug to target cancer at its root cause. Even though the drug treats a cancer that is relatively rare, CML occurs in about 5,000 people per year in the United States, the creation of it proved the principle behind a targeted therapy, which was an entirely new kind of way to make drugs for cancer treatment.
Well, the book starts out in 1959. So what was the state of cancer research then?
So in 1959, when this chromosome was first spotted, so this is a genetic mutation in the cells and blood cells from people with CML, that mutation was spotted through a microscope. And the scientists, Peter Knoll and David Hungerford, had a camera attached to their microscope and took a picture of this genetic mutation. That was the extent of the technology at the time. So there was no way to understand, well, did this mutation cause the cancer? Did the cancer cause the mutation? Was it just incidental? And that was kind of the state of the science at the time. Nobody knew much of anything about where cancer comes from. In fact, the idea that our own genes can mutate and in their mutated state become cancer-causing was just a completely unheard-of notion.
Well, and this is the thing about drug development. Just because you found the chromosome, you don't suddenly have a cure for cancer. That's not how it works. So your book details, quite honestly, seemingly every discovery that had to happen before the discovery of the Philadelphia chromosome could really even be applied to anything. So maybe give us some of those highlights.
So there's so many. I mean, I
know that's highlights.
And that was, I didn't know that when I started writing this book, that there were so many pieces of the puzzle that had to come together, and it kept getting bigger and bigger. And in fact, the story actually stretched back to 1910 to a man named Peyton Rouse, who was a scientist at Rockefeller University. Then it was called Rockefeller Institute in New York City. And this farmer came to him with her hen, and the hen had a big knobby tumor sticking out of its belly. And she came to Peyton Rouse to ask him if he would surgically remove her chicken's tumor. He graciously agreed, and the tumor, he removed the tumor from the hen. The hen did not survive the cancer. It ended up, there were remnants that spread and the chicken died. So, but he took the tumor. He wanted to see what he could learn about cancer from this tumor. I mean, why waste a good tumor? And he purified it, pushed it through some filters, and injected this kind of purified form into another chicken. And that next animal also developed a tumor, which was indicating that it was transmissible, that there was a virus behind it. And what was important about that was not that he had found a contagious cancer, but that the virus that he isolated ended up being used in research for decades to come and made its way into many discoveries that eventually led up to the creation of this drug, one of which was the revelation that our healthy cells, our healthy DNA can mutate, and a gene in its mutated state can sometimes trigger cancer. That understanding can be traced back to this hen that a farmer just happened to bring to Rockefeller University in 1910.
There's such a variety of these discoveries, and you talk about so many of them, but there's some of them that are, I guess, more relevant to this story, or more vital, I should say. So what about the SARC protein?
So that virus also led to a whole other discovery about a certain kind of protein called a kinase. So through many years of research, eventually some scientists, one man in Colorado in particular, identified the kind of gene that was causing the cancer in this virus. So the virus that Peyton Rouse discovered was made, like all viruses, of a few genes. Scientists were able to isolate which gene was responsible for triggering cancer. And then this man, Ray Erickson in Colorado, figured out what kind of gene it was. What was that gene encoding? That gene was encoding a kind of protein called a kinase. And a kinase starts processes in the cell, right? So kinase, kinetic, it sets things in motion. So when you have something that a cell needs to do, like make white blood cells, a kinase is there to say, go, go cell and make some white blood cells now.
Okay, how about oncogenes? Tell me about oncogenes.
An oncogene is a gene that causes cancer, that triggers cancer, or is associated with cancer in some way. Once the gene that was responsible for triggering cancer had been identified in that virus that Peyton Rouse had found, that gene called SARC, once that gene had been found, there were all kinds of questions that that led to. So what kind of gene was it, which was a kinase? But then also there was another question. Where had it come from? What was this virus doing with this gene? Experiments confirmed that the virus didn't need the gene to replicate. So there was no kind of evolutionary reason why it should have been in the virus in the first place. So these two men, Mike Bishop and Harold Varmus, conducted some experiments where they were creating a probe to search for a gene inside the DNA of other animals. It was the pre-cloning era, so doing that kind of work was extremely time-consuming. They were kind of creating a method to do it by making DNA radioactive and then matching it up to other DNA. It was all very complicated and intricate and brilliant. In the end, they found out that that gene, the SARC gene on the cancer-causing virus, had actually come from the chicken. That was a very stunning discovery. Nobody was thinking at the time that genes that cause cancer could be coming from the animal itself. How could that be? But their research proved that SARC was in chicken DNA. They then looked into other animals and found that the SARC gene was in them too. So here was this gene that went back all the way to the Mesozoic era, had been in animals all along, and somehow it had gotten integrated into the virus. And somehow when that happened, the gene mutated and became cancer-causing. This phenomenon was given the technical name called the cellular origin of oncogenes, and the process was called oncogene capture. So what they found out was happening was that a virus could infect a host and inside the host kind of scoop up a gene and integrate it into its own viral DNA or RNA, and then the gene in that, once it was integrated into the virus, could become cancer-causing. Now, when we have a genetic mutation that then triggers cancer, that has nothing to do with a virus. It was just that it proved this idea that healthy genes can mutate and become cancer-causing or become an oncogene. And the healthy state of the gene was termed proto-oncogene.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Jessica Wapner, freelance healthcare and medicine writer and author of The Philadelphia Chromosome. Now, the cast of characters in this book is fairly massive, but one person was very much the driving force behind using all the advances that you were talking about and many others to push for the development of a drug that could treat CML, and that was Brian Druker.
Brian Druker is the head of the Knight Cancer Institute at Oregon Health Science University. He was one of the people behind the creation of this drug, Gleevec. He was one of the lead investigators on the clinical trials. What's very compelling about his story was how much he fought for the drug to get to patients in the first place. So he had grown up in Minnesota and went to medical school eventually, and he was trying to figure out what he wanted to do. Did he want to go into clinical practice and treat patients? Did he want to research in a laboratory? And he actually ended up doing a little bit of both. He was working in a laboratory at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, researching antibodies and some other complex matters. And he was also working at a community hospital not far from there, treating people with different types of cancer. He had gone into cancer care, which at the time had kind of a stigma attached to it. Cancer was a death sentence, and a lot of people who went into it were kind of considered crazy. Why would you choose the one discipline that you're going to just be surrounded by death all the time? And it took him a long time to admit to himself that he wanted to focus on cancer treatment because of that. So we talked about how SARC, which was the gene that caused cancer in this chicken virus, was encoded a protein called a kinase. Well, it turned out that the Philadelphia chromosome did the same thing. There was a kinase called ABL, and ABL triggers the production of white blood cells. In the Philadelphia chromosome mutation, ABL ends up next to another gene called BCR. And together, BCR-ABL become like two teenagers who get into trouble when they're with each other. They're fine when they're apart, but put them together and they are just getting up to mischief. In the case of CML, it's the mischief is the overproduction of white blood cells. You remember that I said kinases can turn on and off. Sometimes they're giving that signal and sometimes they're not giving the signal. In CML, the BCR-ABL kinase is always giving the signal for the cells to produce white blood cells. The signal just never stops. And in the 1980s, people were starting, as this picture came together, people were starting to think, well, would it be possible to make a drug that just blocked that mutant kinase? Brian Druker was one of the people thinking about that. The more that the details emerged over this connection and other kinases started to appear in other types of cancer, the more he started thinking, it is possible to create a drug to block a kinase, and CML will be the first disease to fall to this new approach to treating cancer.
So why was that so difficult? Because it very much was. He ran into a number of obstacles.
One of the things that we have to realize is that this principle had never been proven before. What we know about cancer treatment is our minds go chemotherapy. Chemotherapy is a poison, and it basically is intended to kill the cancer cells before it kills the rest of the body. If it targets anything, it's the fastest growing cells in the body, which is why people lose their hair. And it's also associated with terrible side effects, of course, because of that. But it's a very general mechanism. There's nothing very specific, in a way, about chemotherapy. And chemotherapy drugs had been mostly created by a lot of trial and error. I mean, nitrogen mustard, one of the mainstays of chemotherapy for a long time, had been created for warfare. Blocking of a kinase was a completely new idea. Now, pharmaceutical industries are in the business of making drugs, and that always carries some risk. But creating a drug based on no proven principle was a risk that they were not necessarily willing to take. You'll remember that we talked about how CML is a rare disease. Well, one of the major blocks was also that there was no way that this drug was going to earn the company any money. How was it going to recoup on the investment of clinical trials and applying for approval with the FDA and marketing it and distributing it and producing it? It's a very expensive drug to make. How are they going to put all of that money into making this drug for a disease that occurred in 5,000 people per year?
Okay, but nonetheless, he did finally, with the help of other people, push it to animal trials. So tell us about those.
So there was a kind of a radio silence from the drug company, which at this point it was Novartis, for a long time, because they were doing the animal studies and you need at least 3 months to give it a good go in an animal study. And so Drucker was just waiting to hear. And finally, somebody contacted him with results, and they told him that in a study of dogs that had been given up to about 600 milligrams per day, the highest doses had caused some liver failure. And even in rats, the drugs had caused some liver damage as well, in low doses, I mean. So they needed now to study the liver toxicity. And the warning flags went up. Nobody wanted to do anything else with this drug because of the liver damage. And in fact, people inside the company were looking at this drug saying, not over my dead body will this compound go into man. Well, Brian Drucker said, that's ridiculous because I know the signs of liver damage. If I see my patient is having liver problems, I'm going to stop giving them the drug. We're not going to give patients 600 milligram doses to start off with. We're going to start off at tiny doses. The liver problems were occurring when the doses were sometimes 2000 milligrams or more per day. And the phase one trial that would eventually begin would start at 25 milligrams. So for him, it was a non-issue.
And that's what I found so interesting, because he was both a scientist and a clinician, but he thought about this whole process far more like a clinician quite often.
Yeah, he had been treating cancer patients for years. He knew the signs of side effects and he knew how to treat them. He was a doctor. Yes, he had been doing laboratory research, but he was very well versed in cancer care. And he wanted to lead a clinical trial. If he didn't know how to treat cancer patients, he wouldn't have been leading a clinical trial.
This very well could have, and possibly should have, in a lot of instances, been sort of the nail in the drug's coffin.
It could have been, absolutely. And it very almost was. People inside the company were saying, no way. And the shadow of thalidomide was just hanging over the pharmaceutical industry still. And everybody was fearing that this drug could be the next one. And Jörg Zimmermann, who had created the compound, told me, you know, you have to understand, if we let this drug go into clinical trials and it kills people, then people will then say, well, why did you do that? Right? So they had difficulty from either side, the pharmaceutical company. Because if you don't put it into clinical trials, then it's, well, why did you withhold this potentially life-saving drug? If you do put it into clinical trials and it hurts people, it's, how could you do that?
And we'll be right back with Jessica Wapner to talk more about cancer and the Philadelphia chromosome after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're learning about ecology and biodiversity and the preservation of endangered and even extinct species. We're joined by Eric Dienerstein, lead scientist and vice president for conservation science at the World Wildlife Fund, to discuss his new book, The Kingdom of Rarities, about the challenges involved in studying rare and exotic animals. And we'll speak to Stuart Pym, Doris Duke Chair of Conservation Ecology at Duke University, about his arguments against plans to revive extinct animals. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I've been talking to Jessica Wapner, a New York science and healthcare writer whose blog, Work in Progress, focuses on the ethics and economics of drug development. We've been talking about her book, The Philadelphia Chromosome. Okay, so with all that angst in the lab, how did Drucker talk the powers that be into human clinical trials?
Well, it wasn't just Brian Drucker alone. There were people inside the company that wanted this drug to get into clinical trials. In particular, there was a man named Alex Matter, who one day met the CEO of Novartis, who used to be Daniel Becella, in the hallway and kind of just started ranting about this drug. Becella was relatively new to the company. He did not know about this drug. And Alex Matter is saying to him, "We have to get this drug into clinical trials." And Daniel Becella, you know, he was kind of the first person to finally listen to him and say, "All right, let me look into it." So there were champions inside the company, but Brian Drucker was also tireless fighting for it. And what he did in the end was send a letter to Alex Matter saying, basically, give the drug a chance. He said, "It's time to make a decision. Give the drug a chance." Monitoring for liver toxicity was not complicated because blood tests were going to reveal any problem. At the time, Novartis was conducting studies of the drug in monkeys. And Brian Drucker said, "Well, if you keep going with these monkey studies, all you're going to find out is that either the drug is not harming them or it is, and that's still not going to tell you anything about whether it can help people with CML who are right now dying from their disease." He said, "It's time to make a decision. Let's either put the drug into clinical trials or license it out to a company that will start a clinical trial."
Well, it also sounds like patient activism at a certain point had a lot to do with sort of moving the process along.
Yeah, so that was later in the clinical trial process. What happened was that the phase one study, so that's the very first study of a drug in humans, was going very well. And people started hearing about it online. This was sort of the early times of advocacy online and forums online. And there were CML forums online that people were connecting into, and they were hearing about from a few people in this clinical trial posting their test results and how well they were feeling. And all of these patients were saying, "Well, I want that drug too." When it was time for the phase one study to move into phase two, it was taking too long. There's always a little bit of a lag time between phase one and phase two because phase two is expanded. It's testing a drug in more patients. It's a whole different kind of analysis being conducted. But the drug was so promising that it was very clear the company needed to ramp up production and get the drug to as many patients as possible in this phase two study. But the company was delaying. And in fact, it looked like they might not even take the drug any further. There was a woman in Canada, Susan McNamara, who heard about the drug. She was very, very sick and said, "No way. If there's a drug out there that might help me, there's no way I'm not going to have that." And she led an effort to write a petition and get it signed and send it to Novartis. And at that point, it became very clear that there was going to be a serious PR disaster on their hands if they did not launch the phase two trial. Now, people from Novartis will say they were always planning to run the phase two trial. It just took a long time to get the drug made. It wasn't that easy to produce enough of the drug to start the larger clinical trial. And that's a point of debate that will likely never be resolved, exactly what was going on there, whether the drug was going to be file 13, as Susan McNamara put it, in the trash, or whether it was going to move into phase two.
Now, let's just be clear. How effective was this drug in clinical trials?
The drug proved to be extraordinarily effective very quickly. So in the phase one study, they enrolled one patient per month at three different trial sites. So altogether, it was three patients per month. As early as patient three, they were already seeing blood counts starting to normalize. People with CML have extremely high counts of white blood cells. And by the time they got up to 85 milligrams and then 140 milligrams, the blood counts were going down to normal levels. At 200 milligrams, all of the patients were having these so-called hematologic responses. Their blood counts were normalizing. And there was something else that was happening too. Cells that contained this Philadelphia chromosome were disappearing. The abnormality that was causing CML was actually going away.
So, and we should stress, though, so that people understand, we are not talking about a cure for cancer. A patient has to take this medication forever.
That's right. The patient has to take the drug every day for the rest of their lives, which, of course, is one of the reasons why it ended up being a blockbuster. You see, when the company was doing their calculations and coming again up against the fact that they would not make any money, they were basing those calculations on the fact that chemotherapy would be taken for a few weeks at a time, maybe up to 6 months, every few weeks, something like that. It wasn't something that people took for the rest of their lives. Gleevec has to be taken one pill a day for the rest of their lives. And if a patient does that, they can live a normal, healthy life. So you have people living decades taking this drug.
So how has this research and, I guess, the pursuit of this drug affected cancer research and treatment as a whole?
The creation of Gleevec set the stage for a big change in the way that cancer research is done and in the vision that now guides cancer research and treatment. So first of all, after Gleevec was approved, very quickly there started to be second and third generation versions that were also extremely effective, some of which worked for the few patients who weren't responding to Gleevec, which would sometimes happen. Now there's three or four different so-called kinase inhibitors for CML. There's 15 or so kinase inhibitors approved for other types of cancer as well. And it's a $15 billion a year industry in the US, and that's predicted to double over the next 10 to 15 years. But it's also changed the way that we think about cancer. We're starting to understand cancer as a genetic disease, and efforts to find the driving genetic mutations behind different types of cancer is now the major thrust of cancer research.
We're almost out of time, but I really wanted to ask you one thing. The Orphan Drug Act, you mentioned that in the book. Mm-hmm. Can you just briefly explain what that is? Because it's very important.
So, yes. One of the historic problems medical care faced for a very long time was that nobody was very willing to make drugs for rare diseases. Because, as I explained, rare diseases, by their nature being rare, don't attract business interests. In 1983, the US government passed the Orphan Drug Act, which was to provide incentives for the pharmaceutical industry to focus on these rare diseases, or orphan diseases as they're called. So there's funding for clinical trials, there's a tax credit on trial costs, and there's market exclusivity. So the drug is guaranteed to have a certain number of years of exclusivity on the market. That's slightly different from a patent. It gets too technical. I won't go into it, but it's a huge boon for any drug maker.
Has that done anything for research into rare diseases? Do you know?
Absolutely. By 2010, there were 367 orphan drugs on the market and more than 2,000 in the pipeline.
Jessica, thank you very much for coming by.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can find Jessica Wapner and her book, The Philadelphia Chromosome, at the link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, click the links to Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, where you'll find all the news on upcoming interviews, and then to iTunes, so that you can download past episodes or subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.